Behind the villa, a rock wall rose higher than the house. To the west of the building was a long enclosed garden, and 20 miles away was the carpet of the city of Florence, which often disappeared under the mist of the valley. Rumour had it one of the generals living in the old Medici villa next door had eaten a nightingale. The Villa San Girolamo, built to protect inhabitants from the flesh of the devil, had the look of a besieged fortress, the limbs of most of the statues blown off during the first days of shelling. There seemed little demarcation between house and landscape, between damaged building and the burned and shelled remnants of the earth. To Hannah, the wild gardens were like further rooms. She worked along the edges of them, aware always of unexploded mines. In one soil-rich area beside the house, she began to garden with a furious passion that could come only to someone who had grown up in a city. In spite of the burned earth, in spite of the lack of water, some day there would be a bower of limes, rooms of green light. Caravaggio came into the kitchen to find Hannah sitting hunched over the table. He could not see her face or her arms tucked in under her body, only the naked back, the bare shoulders. She was not still or asleep. With each shudder her head shook over the table. Caravaggio stood there. Those who weep lose more energy than they lose during any other act. It was not yet dawn, her face against the darkness of the table wood. "Hannah," he said, and she stilled herself as if she could be camouflaged by stillness. "Hannah." She began to moan so the sound would be a barrier between them, a river across which she could not be reached. He was uncertain at first about touching her in her nakedness, said, "Hannah," and then lay his bandaged hand on her shoulder. She did not stop shaking. "The deepest sorrow," he thought, "where the only way to survive is to excavate everything." She raised herself, her head down still, then stood up against him as if dragging herself away from the magnet of the table. "Don't touch me if you're going to try and fuck me." The skin pale above her skirt, which was all she wore in this kitchen, as if she had risen from the bed, dressed partially, and come out here, the cool air from the hills entering the kitchen doorway and cloaking her. Her face was red and wet. "Hannah, do you understand? Why do you adore him so much?" "I love him." "You don't love him, you adore him. Go away, Caravaggio, please. You've tied yourself to a corpse for some reason." "He's a saint, I think. A despairing saint. Are there such things? Our desire is to protect them." "He doesn't even care." "I can love him. A 20-year-old who throws herself out of the world to love a ghost." Caravaggio paused. "You have to protect yourself from sadness. Sadness is very close to hate. Let me tell you this. This is the thing I learned. If you take in someone else's poison, thinking you can cure them by sharing it, you will instead store it within you. Those men in the desert were smarter than you. They assumed he could be useful, so they saved him. But when he was no longer useful, they left him." "Leave me alone." When she is solitary, she will sit, aware of the nerve at her ankle, damp from the long grasses of the orchard. She peels a plum from the orchard that she has found and carried in the dark cotton pocket of her dress. When she is solitary, she tries to imagine who might come along the old road under the green hood of the 18 cypress trees. As the Englishman wakes, she bends over his body and places a third of the plum into his mouth. His open mouth holds it, like water, the jaw not moving. He looks as if he will cry from this pleasure. She can sense the plum being swallowed. He brings his hand up and wipes from his lip the last dribble, which his tongue cannot reach, and puts his finger in his mouth to suck it.
"Let me tell you about plums," he says. "When I was a boy..."
After the first nights, after most of the beds had been burned for fuel against the cold, she had taken a dead man's hammock and begun to use it. She would bang spikes into whatever wall she desired, whichever room she wanted to wake in, floating above all the filth and cordite and water on the floors, the rats that had started to appear coming down from the third story. Each night she climbed into the khaki ghost line of hammock she had taken from a dead soldier, someone who had died under her care. A pair of tennis shoes and a hammock, what she had taken from others in this war. She would wake under the slide of moonlight on the ceiling, wrapped in an old shirt she always slept in, her dress hanging on a nail by the door. There was more heat now, and she could sleep this way. Before, when it had been cold, she had had to burn things. Her hammock and her shoes and her frock. She was secure in the miniature world she had built. The two other men seemed distant planets, each in his own sphere of memory and solitude. Caravaggio, who had been her father's gregarious friend in Canada, in those days was capable of standing still and causing havoc within the caravan of women he seemed to give himself over to. He now lay in his darkness. He had been a thief who refused to work with men because he did not trust them, who talked with men, but who preferred talking to women, and when he began talking to women was soon caught in the nets of relationship. When she would sneak home in the early hours of the morning, she would find him asleep on her father's armchair, exhausted from professional or personal robberies. She thought about Caravaggio. Some people you just had to embrace, in some way or another, had to bite into their muscle to remain sane in their company. You needed to grab their hair and clutch it like a drowner so they would pull you into their midst. Otherwise, they, walking casually down the street towards you, almost about to wave, would leap over a wall and be gone for months. As an uncle, he had been a disappearer. Caravaggio would disturb you by simply enfolding you in his arms, his wings. With him you were embraced by character. But now he lay in darkness, like her, in some outpost of the large house. So there was Caravaggio, and there was the desert Englishman. Throughout the war, with all her worst patients, she survived by keeping a coldness hidden in her role as nurse. I will survive this. I won't fall apart at this. These were buried sentences all through her war, all through the towns they crept towards and through Urbino, Anghiari, Monterchi, until they entered Florence and then went farther and finally reached the other sea near Pisa. In the Pisa hospital, she had seen the English patient for the first time, a man with no face, an ebony pool, all identification consumed in a fire. Parts of his burnt body and face had been sprayed with tannic acid that hardened into a protective shell over his raw skin. The area around his eyes was coated with a thick layer of gentian violet. There was nothing to recognize in him. Sometimes she collects several blankets and lies under them, enjoying them more for their weight than for the warmth they bring. And when moonlight slides onto the ceiling, it wakes her, and she lies in the hammock, her mind skating. She finds rest, as opposed to sleep, a truly pleasurable state. If she were a writer, she would collect her pencils and notebooks and favorite cat and write in bed. Strangers and lovers would never get past the locked door. To rest was to receive all aspects of the world without judgment. A bath in the sea, a fuck with a soldier who never knew your name, tenderness towards the unknown and anonymous, which was a tenderness to the self. Her legs move under the burden of military blankets. She swims in their wool as the English patient moved in his cloth placenta. What she misses here is slow twilight, the sound of familiar trees. All through her youth in Toronto she learned to read the summer night. It was where she could be herself, lying in a bed, stepping onto a fire escape, half asleep with a cat in her arms. In her childhood, her classroom had been Caravaggio. He had taught her to somersault. Now, with his hands always in his pockets, he gestures with his shoulders. Who knew what country the war had made him live in? She herself had been trained at Women's College Hospital and then sent overseas during the Sicilian invasion. That was in 1943. The 1st Canadian Infantry Division worked its way up Italy, and the destroyed bodies were fed back to the field hospitals like mud passed back by tunnelers in the dark. After the Battle of Arezzo, when the first barrage of troops recoiled, she was surrounded day and night by their wounds. After 3 full days without rest, She finally lay down on the floor beside a mattress where someone lay dead and slept for 12 hours, closing her eyes against the world around her. When she woke, she picked up a pair of scissors out of the porcelain bowl, leaned over and began to cut her hair, not concerned with shape or length, just cutting it away, the irritation of its presence during the previous days still in her mind, when she had bent forward and her hair had touched blood in a wound. She would have nothing to link her, to lock her to death. She gripped at what was left to make sure there were no more strands, and turned again to face the rooms full of the wounded. She never looked at herself in mirrors again. As the war got darker, she received reports about how certain people she had known had died. She feared the day she would remove blood from a patient's face and discover her father, or someone who had served her food across a counter on Danforth Avenue. She grew harsh with herself and the patients. Reason was the only thing that might save them, and there was no reason. The thermometer of blood moved up the country. Where was and what was Toronto anymore in her mind? This was treacherous opera. People hardened against those around them, soldiers, doctors, nurses, civilians. Hannah bent closer to the wounds she cared for, her mouth whispering to soldiers. She called everyone Buddy and laughed at the song that had the lines, "Each time I chanced to see Franklin D, he always said, 'Hi, Buddy,' to me." She swabbed arms that kept bleeding. She removed so many pieces of shrapnel she felt she'd transported a ton of metal out of the huge body of a human that she was caring for while the army travelled north. One night when one of the patients died, she ignored all rules and took the pair of tennis shoes he had with him in his pack and put them on. They were slightly too big for her, but she was comfortable. Her face became tougher and leaner, the face Caravaggio would meet later. She was thin, mostly from tiredness. She was always hungry and found it a furious exhaustion to feed a patient who couldn't eat or didn't want to, watching the bread crumble away, the soup cool, which she desired to swallow fast. She wanted nothing exotic, just bread, meat. One of the towns had a bread-making section attached to the hospital, and in her free time she moved among the bakers, inhaling the dust and the promise of food. Later, when they were east of Rome, someone gave her a gift of a Jerusalem artichoke. It was strange sleeping in the basilicas or monasteries or wherever the wounded were billeted, always moving north. She broke the small cardboard flag off the foot of the bed when someone died, so the orderlies would know, glancing from a distance. Then she would leave the thick stoned building and walk outside into spring or winter or summer, seasons that seemed archaic, that sat like old gentlemen throughout the war. She would step outside, whatever the weather. She wanted air that smelled of nothing human, wanted moonlight even if it came with a rainstorm. Hello, Buddy. Goodbye, Buddy. Caring was brief. There was a contract only until death. Nothing in her spirit or past had taught her to be a nurse. But cutting her hair was a contract, and it lasted until they were bivouacked in the Villa San Girolamo north of Florence. Here there were 4 other nurses, 2 doctors, 100 patients. The war in Italy moved farther north, and they were what had been left behind. Then, during the celebrations of some local victory, somewhat plaintive in this hill town, she had said she was not going back to Florence or Rome or any other hospital. Her war was over. She would remain with the one burned man they called the English patient, who, it was now clear to her, should never be moved because of the fragility of his limbs. She would lay belladonna over his eyes, give him saline baths for the colloided skin and extensive burns. She was told the hospital was unsafe. The nunnery that had been for months a German defense, barraged with shells and flares by the Allies. Nothing would be left for her. There would be no safety from brigands. She still refused to leave, got out of her nurse's uniform, unbundled the brown print frock she had carried for months, and wore that with her tennis shoes. She stepped away from the war. She had moved back and forth at their desire. Till the nuns reclaimed it, she would sit in this villa with the Englishman. There was something about him she wanted to learn, grow into, and hide in, where she could turn away from being an adult. There was some little waltz in the way he spoke to her and the way he thought. She wanted to save him, this nameless, almost faceless man, who had been one of the 200 or so placed in her care during the invasion north. In her print dress, she walked away from the celebration. She went into the room she shared with the other nurses and sat down. Something flickered in her eye as she sat, and she caught the eye of a small, round mirror. She got up slowly and went towards it. It was very small, but even so seemed a luxury. She had refused to look at herself for more than a year, now and then just her shadow on walls. The mirror revealed only her cheek. She had to move it back to arm's length, her hand wavering. She watched the little portrait of herself as if within a clasped brooch. She. Through the window there was the sound of the patients being brought out into the sunlight in their chairs, laughing and cheering with the staff. Only those who were seriously ill were indoors. She smiled at that. "Hi, buddy," she said. She peered into her look, trying to recognize herself. Darkness between Hannah and Caravaggio as they walk in the garden. Now he begins to talk in his familiar, slow drawl. "It was someone's birthday party late at night on Danforth Avenue. The Nightcrawler restaurant. You remember, Hannah? Everyone had to stand and sing a song. Your father, me, Gianetta, friends. And you said you wanted to as well, for the first time. You were still at school, and you had learned the song in a French class. You did it formally, stood on the bench, and then one more step up onto the wooden table between the plates and the candles burning. Allons enfants! You sang out your left hand to your heart. Allons enfants! Half the people there didn't know what the hell you were singing. Maybe you didn't know what the exact words meant, but you knew what the song was about. The breeze from the window was swaying your skirt over so it almost touched a candle. Your ankles seemed fire white in the bar. Your father's eyes looking up at you, miraculous with his new language, the calls pouring out so distinct, flawless, no hesitations, and the candles swerving away, not touching your dress, but almost touching. We stood up at the end, and you walked off the table into his arms.
I would remove those bandages on your hands. I am a nurse, you know.
They're comfortable, like gloves.
How did this happen?
I was caught jumping from a woman's window. That woman I told you about who took the photograph. Not her fault.
She grips his arm, kneading the muscle.
Let me do it.
She pulls the bandaged hands out of his coat pockets. She has seen them grey in daylight, but in this light they're almost luminous. As she loosens the bandages, he steps backwards, the white coming out of his arms as if he were a magician till he is free of them. She walks towards the uncle from childhood, sees his eyes, hoping to catch hers to postpone this, so she looks at nothing but his eyes. His hands held together like a human bowl. She reaches for them while her face goes up to his cheek, then nestles in his neck. What she holds seems firm, healed.
I tell you, I had to negotiate for what they left me.
How did you do that?
All those skills I used to have.
Oh, I remember. No, don't move. Don't drift away from me.
It is a strange time, the end of a war.
Yes. A period of adjustment.
Yes.
He raises his hands up as if to cup the quarter moon.
They remove both thumbs, Hannah. See?
He holds his hands in front of her, showing her directly what she has glimpsed. He turns one hand over as if to reveal that it is no trick, that what looks like a gill is where the thumb has been cut away. He moves the hand towards her blouse. She feels the cloth lift in the area below her shoulder as he holds it with two fingers and tugs it softly towards him.
I touch cotton like this.
When I was a child, I thought of you always as a Scarlet Pimpernel. And in my dreams I stepped onto the night roofs with you. You came home with cold meals in your pockets, pencil cases, sheet music off some Forest Hill piano for me. She speaks into the darkness of his face, a shadow of leaves washing over his mouth like a rich woman's lace. You like women, don't you? You like them.
I like them. Why the past tense?
It seems important now, with a war and such things. He nods, and the pattern of leaves rolls off him. You used to be like those artists who painted only at night, a single light on in their street,
like the worm-pickers with their old coffee cans strapped to their ankles and the helmet of light shooting down into the grass. All over the city parks. You took me to that place, that cafe where they sold them. It was like a stock exchange, you said, where the price of worms kept dropping and rising, 5 cents, 10 cents. People were ruined or made fortunes, do you remember?
Yes.
Walk back with me, it's getting cold.
The great pickpockets are born with the second and third fingers almost the same length. They do not need to go as deep into a pocket. The great distance of half an inch.
They moved towards the house, under the trees.
Who did that to you?
They found a woman to do it. They thought it was more trenchant. They brought in one of their nurses. My wrists handcuffed to the table legs. When they cut off my thumbs, my hands slipped out of them without a prayer, like a wish in a dream. But the man who called her in, he was really in charge. He was the one, Ranuccio Tomassoni. She was an innocent, knew nothing about me, my name, or nationality, or what I may have done.
When they came into the house, the English patient was shouting. Hannah let go of Caravaggio, and he watched her run up the stairs, her tennis shoes flashing as she ascended and wheeled around with the banister. The voice filled the halls. Caravaggio walked into the kitchen, tore off a section of bread, and followed Hannah up the stairs. As he walked towards the room, the shouts became more frantic. When he stepped into the bedroom, the Englishman was staring at a dog. The dog's head angled back as if stunned by the screaming. Hannah looked over to Caravaggio and grinned.
I haven't seen a dog for years. All through the war I saw no dog.
She crouched and hugged the animal, smelling its hair and the odour of hill grasses within it. She steered the dog towards Caravaggio, who was offering it the heel of bread. The Englishman saw Caravaggio then, and his jaw dropped. It must have seemed to him that the dog, now blocked by Hannah's back, had turned into a man. Caravaggio collected the dog in his arms and left the room.
I have been thinking, the English patient said, that this must be Poliziano's room. This must have been his villa we're in. It is the water coming out of that wall, that ancient fountain. It is a famous room. They all met here.
It was a hospital, she said quietly. Before that, long before that, a nunnery. Then the armies took it over.
I think this was the Villa Bruscoli. Poliziano, the great protégé of Lorenzo. I'm talking about 1483. In Florence, in Santa Trinita Church, you can see the painting of the Medicis with Poliziano in the foreground, wearing a red cloak. Brilliant, awful man. A genius who worked his way up into society.
It was long past midnight, and he was wide awake again. Okay, tell me, she thought. Take me somewhere. Her mind still upon Caravaggio's hands. Caravaggio, who was by now probably feeding the stray dog something from the kitchen of the Villa Bruscoli, if that was what its name was.
It was a bloody life. Daggers and politics and three-decker hats and colonial padded stockings and wigs. Wigs of silk. Of course, Savonarola came later. No, not much later. And there was his Bonfire of the Vanities. Poliziano translated Homer. He wrote a great poem on Simonetta Vespucci. You know her?
No, said Hannah, laughing.
Paintings of her all over Florence. Died of consumption at 23. He made her famous with La Sanze per la Giostra. And then Botticelli painted scenes from it. Leonardo painted scenes from it. Poliziano would lecture every day for 2 hours in Latin in the morning, 2 hours in Greek in the afternoon. He had a friend called Pico della Mirandola, a wild socialite who suddenly converted and joined Savonarola.
That was my nickname when I was a kid, Pico.
Yes, I think a lot happened here. This fountain in the wall, Pico and Lorenzo and Poliziano and the young Michelangelo. They held in each hand the new world and the old world. The library hunted down the last 4 books of Cicero. They imported a giraffe, a rhinoceros, a dodo. Toscanelli drew maps of the world based on correspondence with merchants. They sat in this room with a bust of Plato and argued all night.
And then came Savonarola's cry out of the streets. Repentance, the deluge is coming. And everything was swept away. Free will, the desire to be elegant, fame, the right to worship Plato as well as Christ. Now came the bonfires, the burning of wigs, books, animal hides, maps. More than 400 years later, they opened up the graves. Pico's bones were preserved. Poliziano's had crumbled into dust.
Hannah listened as the Englishman turned the pages of his commonplace book and read the information glued in from other books about great maps lost in the bonfires and the burning of Plato's statue, whose marble exfoliated in the heat, the cracks across wisdom like precise reports across the valley as Poliziano stood on the grass hills, smelling the future. Pico down there somewhere as well, in his grey cell, watching everything with a third eye of salvation. He poured some water into a bowl for the dog, an old mongrel, older than the war. He sat down with the carafe of wine the monks from the monastery had given Hannah. It was Hannah's house, and he moved carefully, rearranging nothing. He noticed her civilization in the small wild flowers, the small gifts to herself. Even in the overgrown garden, he would come across a square foot of grass snipped down with her nurse's scissors. If he'd been a younger man, he would have fallen in love with this. He was no longer young. How did she see him? With his wounds, his unbalance, the grey curls at the back of his neck. He had never imagined himself to be a man with a sense of age and wisdom. They had all grown older, but he still did not feel he had wisdom to go with his aging. He crouched down to watch the dog drinking, and he rebalanced himself too late, grabbing the table, upsetting the carafe of wine. "Your name is David Caravaggio, right?" They had handcuffed him to the thick legs of an oak table. At one point he rose with it in his embrace, blood pouring away from his left hand, and tried to run with it through the thin door and falling. The woman stopped, dropping the knife, refusing to do more. The drawer of the table slid out and fell against his chest and all its contents, and he thought perhaps there was a gun that he could use. Then Ranuccio Tomasini picked up the razor and came over to him. "Caravaggio, right?" He still wasn't sure. As he lay under the table, the blood from his hands fell into his face, and he suddenly thought clearly and slipped the handcuff off the table leg, flinging the chair away to drown out the pain, and then leaning to the left to step out of the other cuff. Blood everywhere now. His hands already useless. For months afterwards he found himself looking at only the thumbs of people, as if the incident had changed him just by producing envy. But the event had produced age. As if during the one night when he was locked to that table, they had poured a solution into him that slowed him. He stood up, dizzy, above the dog, above the red wine-soaked table. Two guards, the woman, Tomasoni, the telephones ringing, ringing, interrupting Tomasoni, who would put down the razor, caustically whisper, "Excuse me," and pick up the phone with his bloody hand and listen. He had, he thought, said nothing of worth to them, but they let him go, so perhaps he was wrong. Then he had walked along the Via di Santo Spirito to the one geographical location he had hidden away in his brain, walked past Brunelleschi's church towards the library of the German Institute, where he knew a certain person would look after him. Suddenly he realized that this was why they had let him go. Letting him walk freely would fool him into revealing this contact. He arced into a side street, not looking back, never looking back. He wanted a street fire so he could staunch his wounds. Hang them over the smoke from a tar cauldron, so black smoke would envelop his hands. He was on the Santa Trinita bridge. There was nothing around, no traffic, which surprised him. He sat on the smooth balustrade of the bridge, then lay back. No sounds. Earlier, when he had walked, his hands in his wet pockets, there had been the manic movement of tanks and jeeps. As he lay there, the mind bridge exploded, and he was flung upwards and then down as part of the end of the world. He opened his eyes, and there was a giant head beside him. He breathed in, and his chest filled with water. He was underwater. There was a bearded head beside him in the shallow water of the Arno. He reached towards it, but couldn't even nudge it. Light was pouring into the river. He swam up to the surface, parts of which were on fire. When he told Hannah the story later that evening, she said, "They stopped torturing you because the Allies were coming. The Germans were getting out of the city, blowing up bridges as they left."
"I don't know. Maybe I told them everything."
"Whose head was it?"
"There were constant phone calls into that room. There would be a hush, and the man would pull back from me, and all of them would watch him on the phone, listening to the silence of the other voice, which we could not hear."
"Whose voice? Whose head?"
"They were leaving, David."
She opens The Last of the Mohicans to the blank page at the back and begins to write in it. "There is a man named Caravaggio, a friend of my father's. I have always loved him. He is older than I am, about 45, I think. He is in a time of darkness, has no confidence. For some reason, I am cared for by this friend of my father." She closes the book and then walks down into the library and conceals it in one of the high shelves. The Englishman was asleep, breathing through his mouth as he always did, awake or asleep. She got up from her chair and gently pulled free the lit candle held in his hands. She walked to the window and blew it out there, so the smoke went out of the room. She disliked his lying there with a candle in his hands, mocking a death-like posture, wax falling unnoticed onto his wrist. As if he was preparing himself, as if he wanted to slip into his own death by imitating its climate and light. She stood by the window and her fingers clutched the hair on her head with a tough grip, pulling it. In darkness, in any light after dusk, you can slit a vein and the blood is black. She needed to move from the room. Suddenly she was claustrophobic, untired. She strode down the hall and leapt down the stairs and went out onto the terrace of the villa, then looked up as if trying to discern the figure of the girl she had stepped away from. She walked back into the building. She pushed at the stiff, swollen door and came into the library, and then removed the boards from the French doors at the far end of the room, opening them, letting in the night air. Where Caravaggio was, she didn't know. He was out most evenings now, usually returning a few hours before dawn. In any case, there was no sign of him. She grabbed the grey sheet that covered the piano and walked away to a corner of the room, hauling it in after her, a winding cloth, a net of fish. No light. She heard a far grumble of thunder. She was standing in front of the piano. Without looking down, she lowered her hands and started to play, just chording sound, reducing melody to a skeleton. She paused after each set of notes, as if bringing her hands out of water to see what she had caught, then continued, placing down the main bones of the tune. She slowed the movements of her fingers even more. She was looking down as two men slipped through the French doors and placed their guns on the end of the piano and stood in front of her, the noise of chords still in the air of the changed room. Her arms down her sides, one bare foot on the bass pedal, continuing with the song her mother had taught her, that she practiced on any surface, a kitchen table, a wall while she walked upstairs, her own bed before she fell asleep. They had no piano. She used to go to the community centre on Saturday mornings and play there, but all week she practiced wherever she was, learning the chalked notes that her mother had drawn onto the kitchen table and then wiped off later. This was the first time she had played on the villa's piano, even though she had been here for 3 months, her eye catching its shape on her first day there through the French doors. In Canada, pianos needed water. You opened up the back and left a full glass of water, and a month later the glass would be empty. Her father had told her about the dwarfs who drank only at pianos, never in bars. She had never believed that, but had at first thought it was perhaps mice. A lightning flash across the valley. The storm had been coming all night, and she saw one of the men was a Sikh. Now she paused and smiled, somewhat amazed, relieved anyway, the cyclorama of light behind them so brief that it was just a quick glimpse of his turban and the bright wet guns. The high flap of the piano had been removed and used as a hospital table several months earlier, so their guns lay on the far side of the ditch of keys. The English patient could have identified the weapons. Hell. She was surrounded by foreign men, Not one pure Italian. A villa romance. What would Poliziano have thought of this 1945 tableau? Two men and a woman across a piano, and the war almost over, and the guns in their wet brightness whenever the lightning slipped itself into the room, filling everything with colour and shadow, as it was doing now. Every half-minute thunder crackling all over the valley, and the music antiphonal, the press of chords, when I take my sugar to tea. Do you know the words? There was no movement from them. She broke free of the chords and released her fingers into intricacy, tumbling into what she had held back, the jazz detail that split open notes and angles from the chestnut of melody. When I take my sugar to tea, all the boys are jealous of me, so I never take her where the gang goes, when I take my sugar to tea. Their clothes wet while they watched her, whenever the lightning was in the room among them, her hands playing now against and within the lightning and thunder, counter to it, filling up the darkness between light. Her face so concentrated they knew they were invisible to her brain struggling to remember her mother's hand ripping newspaper and wetting it under a kitchen tap and using it to wipe the table free of the shaded notes, the hopscotch of keys. After which she went for her weekly lesson at the community hall, where she would play, her feet still unable to reach the pedals if she sat, so she preferred to stand, her summer sandal on the left pedal, and the metronome ticking. She did not want to end this, to give up these words from an old song. She saw the places they went, where the gang never went, crowded with aspidistra. She looked up and nodded towards them, an acknowledgement that she would stop now. Caravaggio did not see all this. When he returned, he found Hannah and the two soldiers from a sapper unit in the kitchen, making up sandwiches. Part 3. Sometime a Fire. The last medieval war was fought in Italy in 1943 and 1944. Fortress towns on great promontories, which had been battled over since the 8th century, had the armies of new kings flung carelessly against them. Around the outcrops of rocks were the traffic of stretchers, butchered vineyards, where, if you dug deep beneath the tank ruts, you found blood axe and spear. Monterchi, Cortona, Urbino, Arezzo, Sansepolcro, Anghiari, and then the coast. Cats slept in the gun turrets looking south. English and Americans and Indians and Australians and Canadians advanced north, and the shell traces exploded and dissolved in the air. When the armies assembled at Sansepolcro, a town whose symbol is the crossbow, some soldiers acquired them and fired them silently at night over the walls of the untaken city. Field Marshal Kesselring of the retreating German army seriously considered the pouring of hot oil from battlements. Medieval scholars were pulled out of Oxford colleges and flown into Umbria. Their average age was 60. They were billeted with the troops, and in meetings with strategic command they kept forgetting the invention of the aeroplane. They spoke of towns in terms of the art in them. At Monterchi there was the Madonna del Parto by Piero della Francesca, located in the chapel next to the town graveyard. When the 13th century castle was finally taken during the spring rains, troops were billeted under the high dome of the church and slept by the stone pulpit where Hercules slays the Hydra. There was only bad water. Many died of typhoid and other fevers. Looking up with service binoculars in the Gothic church at Arezzo, soldiers would come upon their contemporary faces in the Piero della Francesca frescoes. The Queen of Sheba conversing with King Solomon. Nearby a twig from the tree of good and evil inserted into the mouth of the dead Adam. Years later, this queen would realize that the bridge over the Siloam was made from the wood of this sacred tree. It was always raining and cold, and there was no order but for the great maps of art that showed judgment, piety, and sacrifice. The Eighth Army came upon river after river of destroyed bridges, and their sapper units clambered down banks on ladders of rope within enemy gunfire and swam or waded across. Food and tents were washed away. Men who were tied to equipment disappeared. Once across the river, they tried to ascend out of the water. They sank their hands and wrists into the mud wall of the cliff face and hung there. They wanted the mud to harden and hold them. The young Sikh sapper put his cheek against the mud and thought of the Queen of Sheba's face, the texture of her skin. There was no comfort in this river, except for his desire for her, which somehow kept him warm. He would pull the veil off her hair. He would put his right hand between her neck and olive blouse. He, too, was tired and sad, as the wise king and guilty queen he had seen in Arezzo 2 weeks earlier. He hung over the water, his hands locked into the mudbank. Character, that subtle art, disappeared among them during those days and nights, existed only in a book or on a painted wall. Who was sadder in that dome's mural? He leaned forward to rest on the skin of her frail neck. He fell in love with her downcast eye, this woman who would some day know the sacredness of bridges. At night, in the camp bed, his arms stretched out into the distance like two armies. There was no promise of solution or victory except for the temporary pact between him and that painted fresco's royalty who would forget him, never acknowledge his existence or be aware of him, a Sikh halfway up a sapper's ladder in the rain, erecting a Bailey bridge for the army behind him. But he remembered the painting of their story, and when a month later the battalions reached the sea, after they had survived everything and entered the coastal town of Katolika, and the engineers had cleared the beach of mines in a 20-yard stretch so the men could go down naked into the sea, he approached one of the medievalists who had befriended him, who had once simply talked with him and shared some spam, and promised to show him something in return for his kindness. The sapper signed out a Triumph motorbike, strapped a crimson emergency light onto his arm, and they rode back the way they had come, back into and through the now innocent towns like Urbino and Anghiari, along the winding crest of the mountain ridge that was a spine down Italy, the old man bundled up behind him, hugging him, and down the western slope towards Arezzo. The piazza at night was empty of troops, and the sapper parked in front of the church. He helped the medievalist off, collected his equipment, and walked into the church. A colder darkness, a great emptiness, the sound of his boots filling the area. Once more he smelled the old stone and wood. He lit 3 flares. He slung block and tackle across the columns above the nave, then fired a rivet already threaded with rope into a high wooden beam. The professor was watching him bemused, now and then peering up into the high darkness. The young sapper circled him and knotted a sling across his waist and shoulders, taped a small lit flare to the old man's chest. He left him there by the communion rail and noisily climbed the stairs to the upper level, where the other end of the rope was. Holding on to it, he stepped off the balcony into the darkness, and the old man was simultaneously swung up, hoisted up fast, until, when the sapper touched the ground, he swung idly in midair, within 3 feet of the frescoed walls, the flare brightening a halo around him. Still holding the rope, the sapper walked forward until the man swung to the right to hover in front of the flight of Emperor Maxentius. 5 minutes later, he let the man down. He lit a flare for himself and hoisted his body up into the dome within the deep blue of the artificial sky. He remembered its gold stars from the time he had gazed on it with binoculars. Looking down, he saw the medievalist sitting on a bench, exhausted. He was now aware of the depth of this church, not its height, the liquid sense of it, the hollowness and darkness of a well. The flare sprayed out of his hand like a wand. He pulled himself across to her face, his queen of sadness, and his brown hand reached out small against the giant neck. The Sikh sets up a tent in the far reaches of the garden where Hannah thinks lavender was once grown. She has found dry leaves in that area, which she has rolled in her fingers and identified. Now and then, after a rain, she recognizes the perfume of it. At first he will not come into the house at all. He walks past on some duty or other to do with the dismantling of mines, always courteous, a little nod of his head. Hannah sees him wash at a basin of collected rainwater, placed formally on top of a sundial. The garden tap, used in previous times for the seedbeds, is now dry. She sees his shirtless brown body as he tosses water over himself, like a bird using its wing. During the day she notices mostly his arms in the short-sleeved army shirt and the rifle which is always with him, even though battles seem now to be over for them. He has various postures with the gun, half-staff, half a crook for his elbows when it is over his shoulders. He will turn, suddenly realizing she is watching him. He is a survivor of his fears, will step around anything suspicious, acknowledging her look in this panorama, as if claiming he can deal with it all. He is a relief to her in his self-sufficiency, to all of them in the house, though Caravaggio grumbles at the sapper's continuous humming of Western songs he has learnt for himself in the last 3 years of the war. The other sapper, who had arrived with him in the rainstorm, Hardy, he was called, is billeted elsewhere, nearer the town, though she has seen them working together, entering a garden with their wands of gadgetry to clear minds. The dog has stuck by Caravaggio. The young soldier, who will run and leap with the dog along the path, refuses to give it food of any kind, feeling it should survive on its own. If he finds food, he eats it himself. His courtesy goes only so far. Some nights he sleeps on the parapet that overlooks the valley, crawling into his tent only if it rains. He, for his part, witnesses Caravaggio's wanderings at night. On two occasions the sapper trails Caravaggio at a distance, but 2 days later Caravaggio stops him and says, "Don't follow me again!" He begins to deny it, but the older man puts his hand across his lying face and quiets him. So the soldier knows Caravaggio was aware of him 2 nights before. In any case, the trailing was simply a remnant of a habit he had been taught during the war, just as even now he desires to aim his rifle and fire and hit some target precisely. Again and again he aims at a nose on a statue, or one of the brown hawks veering across the sky of the valley. He is still very much a youth. He wolfs down food, jumps up to clear away his plate, allowing himself half an hour for lunch. She has watched him at work, careful and timeless as a cat, in the orchard and within the overgrown garden that rises behind the house. She notices the darker brown skin of his wrist, which slides freely within the bangle that clinks sometimes when he drinks a cup of tea in front of her. He never speaks about the danger that comes with his kind of searching. Now and then an explosion brings her and Caravaggio quickly out of the house, her heart taut from the muffled blast. She runs out or runs to a window, seeing Caravaggio too in the corner of her vision, and they will see the sapper waving lazily towards the house, not even turning around from the herb terrace. Once Caravaggio entered the library and saw the sapper up by the ceiling, against the trompe l'oeil. Only Caravaggio would walk into a room and look up into the high corners to see if he was alone, and the young soldier, his eyes not leaving their focus, put out his palm and snapped his fingers, halting Caravaggio in his entrance. A warning to leave the room for safety as he unthreaded and cut a fuse wire he had traced to that corner, hidden above the valance. He was always humming or whistling.
"Who is whistling?"
asked the English patient one night, having not met or even seen the newcomer, always singing to himself as he lies upon the parapet, looking up at a shift of clouds. When he steps into the seemingly empty villa, he is noisy. He is the only one of them who has remained in uniform. Immaculate, buckles shined, the sapper appears out of his tent, his turban symmetrically layered, the boots clean and banging into the wood or stone floors of the house. On a dime he turns from a problem he is working on and breaks into laughter. He seems unconsciously in love with his body, with his physicalness, bending over to pick up a slice of bread, his knuckles brushing the grass, even twirling the rifle absent-mindedly, like a huge mace as he walks along the path of cypresses to meet the other sappers in the village. He seems casually content with this small group in the villa, some kind of loose star on the edge of their system. This is like a holiday for him after the war of mud and rivers and bridges. He enters the house only when invited in, just a tentative visitor, the way he had done that first night when he had followed the faltering sound of Hannah's piano and come up the cypress-lined path and stepped into the library. He had approached the villa on that night of the storm not out of curiosity about the music, but because of a danger to the piano player. The retreating army often left pencil mines within musical instruments. Returning owners opened up pianos and lost their hands. People would revive the swing on a grandfather clock, and a glass bomb would blow out half a wall and whoever was nearby. He followed the noise of the piano, rushing up the hill with Hardy, climbing over the stone wall and entered the villa. As long as there was no pause, it meant the player would not lean forward and pull out the thin metal band to set the metronome going. Most pencil bombs were hidden in these, the easiest place to solder the thin layer of wire upright. Bombs were attached to taps, to spines of books. They were drilled into fruit trees, so an apple falling onto a lower branch would detonate the tree, just as a hand gripping that branch would. He was unable to look at a room or field without seeing the possibilities of weapons there. He had paused by the French doors, leaned his head against the frame, then slid into the room, and except for moments of lightning remained within the darkness. There was a girl standing, as if waiting for him, looking down at the keys she was playing. His eyes took in the room before they took her in, swept across it like a spray of radar. The metronome was ticking already, swaying innocently back and forth. There was no danger, no tiny wire. He stood there in his wet uniform, the young woman at first unaware of his entrance. Beside his tent, the antenna of a crystal set is strung up into the trees. She can see the phosphorus green from the radio dial if she looks over there at night with Caravaggio's field glasses, the sapper's shifting body covering it up suddenly if he moves across the path of vision. He wears the portable contraption during the day, just one earphone attached to his head, the other loose under his chin, so he can hear sounds from the rest of the world that might be important to him. He will come into the house to pass on whatever information he has picked up that he thinks might be interesting to them. One afternoon, he announces that the band leader Glenn Miller has died, his plane having crashed somewhere between England and France. So he moves among them. She sees him in the distance of a defunct garden with a diviner, or if he has found something, unravelling that knot of wires and fuses, someone has left him like a terrible letter. He is always washing his hands. Caravaggio at first thinks he is too fussy. "How did he get through a war?" Caravaggio laughs. "I grew up in India, uncle. You wash your hands all the time, before all meals, a habit. I was born in the Punjab." "I'm from Upper America," she says. He sleeps half in and half out of the tent. She sees his hands remove the earphone and drop it onto his lap. Then Hannah puts down the glasses and turns away. They were under the huge vault. The sergeant lit a flare, and the sapper lay on the floor and looked up through the rifle's telescope, looking at the ochre faces as if he was searching for a brother in the crowd. The crosshairs shook along the biblical figures, the light dousing the coloured vestments and flesh, darkened by hundreds of years of oil and candle smoke. And now this yellow gas smoke, which they knew was outrageous in this sanctuary, so the soldiers would be thrown out, would be remembered for abusing the permission they received to see the great hall, which they had come to, wading up beachheads and the 1,000 skirmishes of small wars and the bombing of Monte Cassino, and then walking in hushed politeness through the Raphael Stanze, till they were here, finally, 17 men who had landed in Sicily and fought their way up the ankle of the country to be here, where they were offered just a mostly dark hall, as if being in the presence of the place was enough. And one of them had said, "Damn! Maybe more lights, Sergeant Shand." And the sergeant released the catch of the flare and held it up in his outstretched arm, the Niagara of its light pouring off his fist, and stood there for the length of its burn like that. The rest of them stood up looking at the figures and faces crowded onto the ceiling that emerged in the light. But the young sapper was already on his back, the rifle aimed, his eye almost brushing the beards of Noah and Abraham and the variety of demons, until he reached the great face and was stilled by it, the face like a spear, wise, unforgiving. The guards were yelling at the entrance, and he could hear the running steps, just another 30 seconds left on the flare. He rolled over and handed the rifle to the padre. "That one, who is he? At 3 o'clock northwest. Who is he? Quick, the flare is almost out." The padre cradled the rifle and swept it over to the corner, and the flare died. He returned the rifle to the young Sikh. "You know, we shall all be in serious trouble over this lighting of weapons in the Sistine Chapel. I should not have come here. But I also must thank Sergeant Shand. He was heroic to do it. No real damage has been done, I suppose."
"Did you see it? The face? Who was it?"
"Ah, yes, it is a great face."
"You saw it?"
"Yes, Isaiah."
When the Eighth Army got to Gabiche on the east coast, the sapper was head of night patrol.
On the second night, he received a signal over the shortwave that there was enemy movement in the water. The patrol sent out a shell and the water erupted, a rough warning shot. They did not hit anything, but in the white spray of the explosion, he picked up a darker outline of movement. He raised the rifle and held a drifting shadow in his sights for a full minute, deciding not to shoot in order to see if there would be other movement nearby. The enemy was still camped up north in Rimini, on the edge of the city. He had the shadow in his sights when the halo was suddenly illuminated around the head of the Virgin Mary. She was coming out of the sea. She was standing in a boat. Two men rowed. Two other men held her upright, and as they touched the beach, the people of the town began to applaud from their dark and opened windows. The sapper could see the cream-coloured face and the halo of small battery lights. He was lying on the concrete pillbox between the town and the sea, watching her as the four men climbed out of the boat and lifted the 5-foot-tall plaster statue into their arms. They walked up the beach without pausing, no hesitation for the mines. Perhaps they had watched them being buried and charted them when the Germans had been there. Their feet sank into the sand. This was Gabice Mare on May 29, 1944, Marine Festival of the Virgin Mary. Adults and children were on the streets. Men in band uniforms had also emerged. The band would not play and break the rules of curfew, but the instruments were still part of the ceremony, immaculately polished. He slid from the darkness, the mortar tube strapped to his back, carrying the rifle in his hands. In his turban and with the weapons, he was a shock to them. They had not expected him to emerge, too, out of the no-man's land of the beach. He raised his rifle and picked up her face in the gunsight, ageless, without sexuality, the foreground of the men's dark hands reaching into her light, the gracious nod of the 20 small light bulbs. The figure wore a pale blue cloak, her left knee raised slightly to suggest drapery. They were not romantic people. They had survived the fascists, the English, Gauls, Goths, and Germans. They had been owned so often it meant nothing. But this blue and cream plaster figure had come out of the sea, was placed in a grape truck full of flowers, while the band marched ahead of her in silence. Whatever protection he was supposed to provide for this town was meaningless. He couldn't walk among their children in white dresses with these guns. He moved one street south of them, and walked at the speed of the statue's movement, so they reached the joining streets at the same time. He raised his rifle to pick up her face once again in his sights. It all ended on a promontory overlooking the sea, where they left her and returned to their homes. None of them was aware of his continued presence on the periphery. Her face was still lit. The four men who had brought her by boat sat in a square around her like sentries. The battery attached to her back began to fade. It died at about 4:30 in the morning. He glanced at his watch then. He picked up the men with the rifle telescope. Two were asleep. He swung the sights up to her face and studied her again, a different look in the fading light around her, a face which in the darkness looked more like someone he knew, a sister, someday a daughter. If he could have parted with it, the sapper would have left something there as his gesture. But he had his own faith, after all. Caravaggio enters the library. He has been spending most afternoons there. As always, books are mystical creatures to him. He plucks one out and opens it to the title page. He is in the room about 5 minutes before he hears a slight groan. He turns and sees Hannah asleep on the sofa. He closes the book and leans back against the thigh-high ledge under the shelves. She is curled up, her left cheek on the dusty brocade and her right arm up towards her face, a fist against her jaw. Her eyebrows shift, the face concentrating within sleep. When he had first seen her after all this time, she'd looked taut, boiled down to just body enough to get her through this efficiently. Her body had been in a war, and as in love, it had used every part of itself. He sneezed out loud, and when he looked up from the movement of his tossed-down head, she was awake, the eyes open, staring ahead at him. "Guess what time it is?"
"About 4:05. No, 4:07," she said.
It was an old game between a man and a child. He slipped out of the room to look for the clock, and by his movement and assuredness you could tell he had recently taken morphine, was refreshed and precise with his familiar confidence. She sat up and smiled when he came back, shaking his head with wonder at her accuracy. I was born with a sundial in my head, right? And at night? Do they have moon dials? Has anyone invented one? Perhaps every architect preparing a villa hides a moon dial for thieves, like a necessary tithe.
A good worry for the rich.
Meet me at the moon dial, David, a place where the weak can enter the strong.
Like the English patient and you?
I was almost going to have a baby a year ago. Now that his mind is light and exact with the drug, she can whip around and he'll be with her, thinking alongside her. And she is being open, not quite realizing she is awake and conversing, as if still speaking in a dream, as if his sneeze had been the sneeze in a dream. Caravaggio is familiar with this state. He has often met people at the moon dial, disturbing them at 2 a.m. as a whole bedroom cupboard came crashing down by mistake. Such shocks, he discovered, kept them away from fear and violence. Disturbed by owners of houses he was robbing, he would clap his hands and converse frantically, flinging an expensive clock into the air and catching it in his hands, quickly asking them questions about where things were. I lost the child. I mean, I had to lose it. The father was already dead. There was a war.
Were you in Italy?
In Sicily, about the time this happened. All through the time we came up the Adriatic behind the troops, I thought of it. I had continued conversations with the child. I worked very hard in the hospitals and retreated from everybody around me, except the child, who I shared everything with, in my head. I was talking to him while I bathed and nursed patients. I was a little crazy.
And then your father died?
Yes, then Patrick died. I was in Pisa when I heard. She was awake, sitting up. You knew, huh?
I got a letter from home.
Is that why you came here? Because you knew?
No.
Good. I don't think that he believed in wakes and such things. Patrick used to say he wanted a duet by two women on musical instruments when he died. Squeeze box and violin, that's all. He was so damn sentimental.
Yep, you could really make him do anything. Find him a woman in distress and he was lost.
The wind rose up out of the valley to their hill, so the cypress trees that lined the 36 steps outside the chapel wrestled with it. Drops of earlier rain nudged off, falling with a ticking sound upon the two of them sitting on the balustrade by the steps. It was long after midnight. She was lying on the concrete ledge, and he paced or leaned out looking down into the valley. Only the sound of the dislodged rain.
When did you stop talking to the baby?
It all got too busy suddenly. Troops were going into battles at the Morro Bridge and then into Urbino. Maybe in Urbino I stopped. You felt you could be shot any time there. Not just if you were a soldier, but a priest or nurse. It was a rabbit warren, those narrow, tilted streets. Soldiers were coming in with just bits of their bodies, falling in love with me for an hour and then dying. It was important to remember their names, but I kept seeing the child whenever they died, being washed away. Some would sit up and rip all their dressings off, trying to breathe better. Some would be worried about tiny scratches on their arms when they died. Then the bubble in the mouth, that little pop. I leaned forward to close a dead soldier's eyes, and he opened them and sneered, "Can't wait to have me dead, you bitch!" He sat up and swept everything on my tray to the floor, so furious. Who would want to die like that? To die with that kind of anger? "You bitch!" After that, I always waited for the bubble in their mouths. I know death now, David. I know all the smells. I know how to divert them from agony, when to give them the quick jolt of morphine in a major vein. A saline solution to make them empty their bowels before they die. Every damn general should have had my job. Every damn general. It should have been a prerequisite for any river crossing. Who the hell were we to be given this responsibility? Expected to be wise as old priests, to know how to lead people towards something no one wanted and somehow make them feel comfortable? I could never believe in all those services they gave for the dead, their vulgar rhetoric. How dare they? How dare they talk like that about a human being dying? There was no light. All lamps out. The sky mostly cloud-hidden. It was safer not to draw attention to the civilization of existing homes. They were used to walking the grounds of the house in darkness. You know why the army didn't want you to stay here with the English patient, do you? An embarrassing marriage? My father complex? She was smiling at him. How's the old guy? He still hasn't calmed down about that dog. Tell him he came with me. He's not really sure you're staying here either. Thinks you might walk off with a china. Do you think he would like some wine? I managed to scrounge a bottle today. From? Do you want it or not? Let's just have it now. Let's forget him. Ah, the breakthrough. Not the breakthrough. I badly need a serious drink. 20 years old. By the time I was 20... Yes, yes. Why don't you scrounge a gramophone someday? By the way, I think this is called looting. My country taught me all this. It's what I did for them during the war.
He went through the bomb chapel into the house. Hannah sat up, slightly dizzy, off balance.
And look what they did to you, she said to herself. Even among those she worked closely with, she hardly talked during the war. She needed an uncle, a member of the family. She needed the father of a child, while she waited in this hill town to get drunk for the first time in years, while a burned man upstairs had fallen into his 4 hours of sleep, and an old friend of her father's was now rifling through her medicine chest, breaking the glass tab, tightening a bootlace round his arm, and injecting the morphine quickly into himself, in the time it took for him to turn around. At night, in the mountains around them, even by 10 o'clock, only the earth is dark. Clear grey sky and the green hills. I was sick of the hunger, of just being lusted at. So I stepped away from the dates, the jeep rides, the courtship, the last dances before they died. I was considered a snob. I worked harder than the others, double shifts under fire, did anything for them, emptied every bedpan. I became a snob because I wouldn't go out and spend their money. I wanted to go home. And there was no one at home. And I was sick of Europe, sick of being treated like gold because I was female. I courted one man and he died, and the child died. I mean, the child didn't just die. I was the one who destroyed it. After that, I stepped so far back, no one could get near me. Not with talk of snobs, not with anyone's death. Then I met him, the man burned black, who turned out to be, up close, an Englishman. It has been a long time, David, since I thought of anything to do with a man.
After a week of the Sikh sapper's presence around the villa, they adapted to his habits of eating. Wherever he was, on the hill or in the village, he would return around 12:30 and join Hannah and Caravaggio, pull out the small bundle of blue handkerchief from his shoulder bag and spread it onto the table alongside their meal. His onions and his herbs, which Caravaggio suspected he was taking from the Franciscan's garden during the time he spent there sweeping the place for mines. He peeled the onions with the same knife he used to strip rubber from a fuse wire. This was followed by fruit. Caravaggio suspected he had gone through the whole invasion, never eating from a mess canteen. In fact, he'd always been dutifully in line at the crack of dawn, holding out his cup for the English tea he loved, adding to it his own supply of condensed milk. He would drink slowly, standing in sunlight to watch the slow movement of troops, who, if they were stationary that day, would already be playing canasta by 9 a.m. Now, at dawn, under the scarred trees in the half-bombed gardens of the Villa San Girolamo, he takes a mouthful of water from his canteen. He pours tooth powder onto the brush and begins a 10-minute session of lackadaisical brushing as he wanders around, looking down into the valley, still buried in the mist, his mind curious rather than awestruck at the vista he happens now to be living above. The brushing of teeth since he was a child has always been for him an outdoor activity. The landscape around him is just a temporary thing. There is no permanence to it. He simply acknowledges the possibility of rain, a certain odor from a shrub. As if his mind, even when unused, is radar,
his eyes locating the choreography of inanimate objects for a quarter mile around him, which is the killing radius of small arms. He studies the two onions he has pulled out of the earth with care, aware that gardens too have been mined by retreating armies. At lunch there is Caravaggio's avuncular glance at the objects on the blue handkerchief. There is probably some rare animal, Caravaggio thinks, who eats the same foods that this young soldier eats with his right hand, his fingers carrying it to his mouth. He uses the knife only to peel the skin from the onion, to slice fruit. The two men take a trip by cart down into the valley to pick up a sack of flour. Also, the soldier has to deliver maps of the cleared areas to headquarters at San Domenico. Finding it difficult to ask questions about each other, they speak about Hannah. There are many questions before the old man admits to having known her before the war.
In Canada?
Yes, I knew her there. They pass numerous bonfires on the sides of the road, and Caravaggio diverts the young soldier's attention to them. The sapper's nickname is Kip. Get Kip. Here comes Kip. The name had attached itself to him curiously. In his first bomb disposal report in England, some butter had marked his paper, and the officer had exclaimed, "What's this, kipper grease?" And laughter surrounded him. He had no idea what a kipper was, but the young Sikh had been thereby translated into a salty English fish. Within a week, his real name, Kirpal Singh, had been forgotten. He hadn't minded this. Lord Suffolk and his demolition team took to calling him by his nickname, which he preferred to the English habit of calling people by their surname. That summer, the English patient wore his hearing aid so he was alive to everything in the house. The amber shell hung within his ear with its translations of casual noises, the chair in the hall scraping against the floor, the click of the dog's claws outside his room, so he would turn up the volume and even hear its damn breathing or the shout on the terrace from the sapper. The English patient, within a few days of the young soldier's arrival, had thus become aware of his presence around the house, though Hannah kept them separate, knowing they would probably not like each other. But she entered the Englishman's room one day to find the sapper there. He was standing at the foot of the bed, his arms hung over the rifle that rested across his shoulders. She disliked this casual handling of the gun, his lazy spin towards her entrance as if his body were the axle of a wheel, as if the weapon had been sewn along his shoulders and arms and into his small brown wrists. The Englishman turned to her and said,
"We're getting along famously."
She was put out that the sapper had strolled casually into this domain, seemed able to surround her, be everywhere. Kip, hearing from Caravaggio that the patient knew about guns, had begun to discuss the search for bombs with the Englishman. He had come up to the room and found him a reservoir of information about Allied and enemy weaponry. The Englishman not only knew about the absurd Italian fuses, but also knew the detailed topography of this region of Tuscany. Soon they were drawing outlines of bombs for each other and talking about the theory of each specific circuit. "The Italian fuses seem to be put in vertically, and not always at the tail."
"Well, that depends. The ones made in Naples are that way, but the factories in Rome follow the German system. Of course, Naples, going back to the 15th century."
It meant having to listen to the patient talk in his circuitous way, and the young soldier was not used to remaining still and silent. He would get restless, and kept interrupting the pauses and silences the Englishman always allowed himself, trying to energize the train of thought. The soldier rolled his head back and looked at the ceiling. "What we should do is make a sling," the sapper mused, turning to Hannah as she entered, "and carry him around the house." She looked at both of them, shrugged, and walked out of the room. When Caravaggio passed her in the hall, she was smiling. They stood in the hall and listened to the conversation inside the room.
"Did I tell you my concept of the Virgilian man, Kip? Let me..."
"Is your hearing aid on?"
"What?"
"Turn it..."
"I think he's found a friend," she said to Caravaggio,